Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are blessed to have with us from time to time a man of uncommon intelligence who has, I'm very happy to say, brought it to bear on behalf of our governments in a number of capacities over the years, including notably as one of the duty experts on nuclear weapons and deterrence and arms control and verification issues in the Department of Defense. I had the privilege of working with him there decades ago under President Reagan, and he went on to serve with great distinction in that capacity, as well as previously in the role of as a foreign service officer. These days, he is a senior analyst with the National Institute for Public Policy, and his name is Dr. Mark Schneider. A very welcome guest always, and especially at a moment such as this. Mark Schneider, we had the privilege of talking with one of your colleagues at NIPP yesterday, Michaela Dodge. We're very glad to be able to follow up with you today. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, and a happy new year to you, I guess.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here, and a very happy new year to you.
Let me ask you, Mark, to help flesh out a topic that we began to discuss with Michaela yesterday, namely the kind of threat environment we're facing. Most of us are not paying much attention to what the Russians and the Chinese are doing with their nuclear weapons programs. You follow this very closely. Let's start with the Russians and just give us sort of the latest assessment of how their modernization program is coming and what it entails.
Well, it's massive. I mean, this is actually their characterization of it, not mine per se, but it really is massive. There are over 20 announced modernization programs, either involving new systems or modernized older systems. The large majority of the 20 plus are new systems. So there's not a remote comparison between the scope of their modernization and the scope of our modernization. I'm going to give you a lot of statistics that they just released. Every time I give you a Russian number, keep in your mind that the comparable U.S. number in 100% of the cases is zero. They say that they have modernized, this is the commander of Strategic Missile Forces, 81% of their ICBMs, and the modernization is almost 100% new systems rather than improvements in legacy Soviet systems. Overall, they say they've modified, they modernized 86% of their strategic nuclear triad by the end of last year, and that they will reach over 88% this year. Russian modernization is literally never ending. They will, the minute they bring a new system on board, they're already working on either a follow-on system for this new system or a substantial improvement of this new system. So it's the overall program is completely different than ours. It in every category of the triad, the bombers, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine-launched ballistic missiles, they have several programs underway involving either new or modernized legacy systems.
Mark, talk about two things, if you would, in particular in this connection, in addition to this astounding level of effort to replace missiles and bombers and submarines. You also have new technologies like hypersonic missiles and warheads that we believe are different in kind and capability than things that have been in their arsenal before. What is the contribution those kinds of additional improvements make to the capacity of the Soviet legacy systems and their current counterparts to wage thermonuclear war against this country?
Well, it's very considerable, and that's I mean, they make no bones about the fact that these systems are designed for war fighting. Within the last month and a half or so, they have made numerous statements about how they have to maintain high combat readiness, and that 95% of their ICBM force is combat ready at all times. The hypersonic missiles is the new program. They have a monopoly on these. All of these systems, according to their statements or according to Russian press reports, are either nuclear only or nuclear capable. Their mission, by the way, is not the stated mission of penetrating U.S. defenses. They easily can do that without these systems. As I see it, the main mission of the hypersonic missiles is preemptive nuclear strike. The Avangard, the ICBM range boost glide vehicle, is designed to take out the U.S. National Command authority, the President, the Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, very, very quickly in the event of war, and they hope...
Decapitate, in other words.
Decapitate, yes. They hope that it will prevent any effective response to their attack. And there's such a massive difference between our system, our nuclear command and control system, and theirs. They're not even in the same ballpark. We call our system, and I think this is the greatest Freudian slip in history, the nuclear thin line. It's very, very thin.
Mark Schneider, let me just ask you, and I want to come to China here in a moment, but most Americans, I think it's fair to say, think the Cold War ended and the threat from Russia, the Kremlin, the former Soviet Union, whatever you wish to call it, has accordingly gone away. What you're describing is an abiding determination on the part of Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia, to essentially be able, at will, to eliminate the United States using nuclear warfighting capabilities. Have I got that about right?
Yes, I think that's very much so. They want to use the threat of nuclear war, and they are constantly doing this in a variety of ways. They alternate really between peace offensives and massive nuclear threat offensives. They threaten nuclear first use. They threaten nuclear bomber attack by flying their bombers into our air defense identification zones. Their defense minister, General of the Army, Shoigu, bragged on December 21st that they did that 50 times in 2020.
And not least, you have Vladimir Putin himself presiding over these exercises as the man who is putting, you know, his finger to the button to unleash a thermonuclear attack against this country. Mark, we have to pause for just a moment. We're going to come back for a second continuing piece of this discussion, focusing in on the Chinese Communist Party's nuclear deterrent or attack capabilities and what we best be doing about both those of Russia and China. With Dr. Mark Schneider, man of extraordinary corporate memory and great clarity about the threats we're facing, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and we're visiting with Dr. Mark Schneider, a man who has served in a variety of capacities in our country. In fact, an extraordinary array, from the Defense Department and the Office of the Secretary of Defense to the Department of Energy and the State Department, in the role of a professional staff member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and now with the National Institute for Public Policy. Mark Schneider, you've given us a very alarming description of what Vladimir Putin is doing. Talk a bit about his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and what China is doing, as best we can tell, in terms of amassing its own thermonuclear warfighting capability as well.
Well, I think there's massive similarity between Russian and Chinese program, and I believe that Russian and Chinese nuclear doctrine is actually much closer than is ordinarily recognized. Ambassador Billingsley and Secretary of State Pompeo have done a great job in highlighting, particularly recently, the scope of the Chinese nuclear buildup. Now, they're using the official U.S. Numbers. I think the numbers on the size of the Chinese nuclear arsenal are underestimated enormously. However, there is no doubt at all that they have multiple systems, and they've literally displayed these in military parades, new ballistic missiles, new ICBMs, new intermediate range missiles, new short range missiles, increasing, even by their own admissions, increasing percentage of those being nuclear capable. And that buildup is continuing, and like the Russian build up, it is literally never ending. They go from one system to the next system to the next system, and they are going for an enhanced military capability and enhanced warfighting capability. And we ignore this threat at our own peril. There's no question about that.
And Mark, one of the things that they're also doing, as I understand it, as the Chinese have historically done, and as you've documented over the years, the Russians have done as well, and the Soviets before them, is engage in concealment and deception to obscure wherever they can some of these capabilities that they're bringing to bear, notably with this unbelievable 3,000-mile underground tunnel complex in which we believe nuclear missiles are being hidden, among perhaps other things. To the extent that we are confronting not one but two of these massively armed adversaries, deeply committed to improving and expanding their nuclear threats to us, the problem is made worse, as I understand it, by virtue of the fact that they seem not only to be sort of pursuing parallel programs, but collaborating in their strategic nuclear endeavors, including, I gather, some exercises. Talk a bit about that, if you would.
Well, yes. There are reports going back literally decades, press reports about, in effect, technology transfer from Russia to China in many areas, including the strategic nuclear force capability. And in the last 2 years in particular, there has been increased Chinese involvement in major Russian exercises, exercises that reportedly go nuclear. There was a fairly recent incident in which operation by both Russian and Chinese heavy bombers, nuclear-capable aircraft, flew very far into South Korean air defense identification zones, and according to the press reports, that was followed within a few hours by a simulated attack in which 15 fighter bombers flew into the same area. So we're seeing and there was even Chinese involvement in an exercise in the Baltic, which is aimed at, threatening NATO. All their exercises have that as at least a secondary aim. So we've seen, I think, unprecedented cooperation between the two and their involvement in this threatmanship.
To put a fine point on it, Mark Schneider, when you use the term these exercises go nuclear, you're talking about simulating, again, thermonuclear attacks against the United States, and a degree, it seems, of cooperation in doing so between the Russians and the Chinese. Is that correct?
Well, the the exercises that the Chinese are involved on, in at this point have been the major theater exercises. Now, there are reports going back 20 years that essentially 100% of Russian theater exercises end in a nuclear phase, either a tactical nuclear phase or a strategic nuclear phase, or both. The large strategic nuclear exercise, which is normally conducted in October, but this year was conducted in December, is basically it's nuclear only. It reportedly involves an escalation scenario. The content of the exercises are revealed to varying degrees. Last year, the year before last year, we had enormous information released. This year, they were much more tight-lipped about what they did. So we don't know nearly as much of the details, but what we do know is, as normal, Putin presided over it, and we saw a record number of actual live launches of ballistic missiles, 6 compared to typically 3 to 4 in previous exercises. As part of this one, you had a salvo launch of 4 Bulova 30 SLBMs, their most modern system. The unique aspect of this year's exercise, despite the fact we know much less about the details in it, is that almost all of the, all of the missiles, the 6 missiles involved, were either new, 5 of them, or modernized, the 6. So this is unprecedented. And it's very expensive, by the way.
Mark Schneider, as we spoke of earlier, I talked with Michaela Dodge, also of the National Institute for Public Policy, yesterday, and asked her about what are the prospects in a new Biden-Harris administration that we will step up and take the sorts of actions in terms of modernizing our own nuclear deterrent capabilities that are clearly mandatory in the face of the sorts of threats and seeming intentionality behind those threats emanating now from Moscow and Beijing.
Well, the press reports, and I don't claim any slightest inside information about what Biden is going to do, but all the press reports I've seen, and there have been a significant number of them, are saying he plans large cuts in the nuclear forces. And that's really bad news. I mean, this is exactly what Putin wants to happen. And the impact of that on deterrence, depending on how severe these things are, could be very, very, very considerable. And it could encourage him to try military action in Europe.
Or someplace. I guess that's the point. And when you're talking about cuts, you're talking about not just the postponement or reduction in the modernization programs that we have, such as they are, and they're basically long-term. And I would argue inadequate. But you're also talking about reducing the actual existing forces that we have. We talked with Michaela about the Intercontinental Range Ballistic Missile Force, now the Minuteman III Force, some of it 50 years old, but it's what we have. And that might be subject to elimination, as I understand it, according to at least some of the people that seem to be influential with this incoming team. Is that your understanding as well? And is that what you're referring to that could really give rise to grave dangers for our country?
Well, that's what the press, and I'm not talking about conservative media, I'm talking about liberal media, is saying. It could very well be true, because clearly the people that he is bringing on are liberals, and for many decades they have fought against our nuclear capability. I'm pessimistic about what the result is going to be. Now, this is not really we're not really talking about cuts in the Trump program. We're talking about large-scale cuts compared to what the Obama program was, and that's pretty frightening, quite frankly.
Mark, I so appreciate your taking the time and visiting with us about these issues. They seem arcane. They're obviously frightening, but we have to pay attention to them. And this is one of the services that we think this program provides in terms of these, well, I call them intelligence briefings. It really is vital that the American people be pressing the next president and his administration to step up to the sorts of threats we are now facing, let alone what may be in the offing from Russia and China, to say nothing of lesser powers. Iran is about to enter the ranks of these nuclear weapon states, it seems. Certainly North Korea. Thank you, Mark, for your expertise, your incredible collective service, going back, as I read it, to the Atomic Energy Commission, which is ancient history. But you've served so long and so well, and we really appreciate your contributions to this program and look forward to many more of them in 2021. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Next up, Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired. We'll talk with him about what China is up to, not just at the nuclear level, but the tactical level as well, and what it means for us and our allies and freedom in that region. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm pleased to say we're joined by a man I've come to admire greatly and very much appreciate his continuing service to our country. He served for many years as a member of the United States military, rose through the ranks to the distinction of a colonel in the United States Marine Corps. He has been a foreign service officer as well and an international businessman based in Japan for years. He is now a senior fellow with the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies and with, I'm pleased to say, the Center for Security Policy here in Washington. His name is Grant Newsom, and he is one of our regulars here because we value enormously his insights into the state of our security and other foreign policy interests in a very dynamic and increasingly volatile part of the world. Grant Newsom, it's good to have you back. Happy New Year to you. It's more of an aspiration than an expectation, honestly, but I pass it along with heartfelt sincerity.
Well, thanks very much. It's got to get better. I think there's still 11 and a half months left.
We need it to get better. I'm not sure that it's the same thing. Grant, I just was talking with Mark Schneider about the strategic threat environment that is developing, and I have the feeling that people closer to China than we are, and Russia for that matter, are very much mindful of the things that Mark shared with us in terms of the nuclear buildup, as well as the increasing aggressiveness of these two powers, especially as they make common cause increasingly. I'd like to talk with you about how that looks from sort of the front lines where you find yourself in Japan, and in particular, how the Chinese are using both our nominal ally, South Korea, and their own military power to try to divide us from our allies in the region and divide our allies, for that matter, in the region from each other.
Well, that's what China does. It's all about breaking up alliances. And you mentioned South Korea. The Chinese, it's really a political effort, an economic effort as much as anything, to try and create friction and weaken the U.S.-South Korea alliance. And the current administration in South Korea is, I think, more pro-Chinese. It's, one could argue, and I think should argue, is fundamentally anti-American. So it is actually in line with what China has in mind. It sees America as the reason the peninsula is divided. But most Koreans don't agree with that. So that's something of an advantage. But you look at the Chinese, particularly the economic, commercial pressure, the efforts to so-called capture elites, which is basically bribe people with influence throughout the region, well into the Pacific as well. And that's all intended to weaken U.S. alliances. So that's really on the commercial, political, economic angle. But all of the Chinese military buildup that you see, and the Chinese military being out and about in more places, building up its capabilities, and making sure that everyone sees it. That, too, is intended to sort of wear people down psychologically.
Among the targets for this psychological campaign, as well as the threat of kinetic action from China, is, of course, Taiwan. Just quickly remind us of the strategic significance of Taiwan to the United States, to our interests in the region, and how acute do you think the threat to Taiwan is at the moment from the CCP?
I think it's the threat is immense. I think every day when I wake up, if I were to hear that some bit of Chinese territory, say an offshore island, had been seized by the Chinese, it wouldn't surprise me.
A bit of Taiwanese territory, you say?
That's right, yeah. Taiwan has a number of little islands sort of offshore and down in the South China Sea. That would be and a few very close to China. That would be sort of a good place to start. So there is also, the political threat, the constant hectoring and most vitriolic language imaginable, plus playing to the United States, trying to tell the Americans, well, Taiwan's not really worth it. You don't want to go to war, do you? But if you look at Taiwan's position on the map, it's right in the middle of America's first defense line and the so-called first island chain. If Taiwan goes, that is the equivalent, say, if you have a castle, of the wall being breached. And you can imagine what the problems are there. Lose Taiwan or let it come under Chinese domination. And most of the rest of Asia will go red, to use the old expression, within a very short time. That's how serious it is.
We have some other allies in the area. In fact, they were a focus of a new strategic framework. Well, I shouldn't say new. It's newly released and declassified form, but it was adopted, I believe, in 2017. We talked with our colleague, Captain James Fennell, about it a bit earlier in the week. But I imagine you've had a chance to study it as well, Grant Newsom, and I wonder what your takeaways are from it in terms of both the strategic vision it describes and the implementation of that vision to date by the Trump administration.
Well, you're referring to the strategic document that was declassified? Yes, well, that, if you read it, it is a very, very well-written document. You see Matt Pottinger's the National Security Council, Asia director's hands all over it. But it's a very good, broad, comprehensive, systematic approach or sort of memorialization of how to go about protecting and asserting U.S. interests in Asia, Pacific, and our friends' interests as well. And it's also, it was written, obviously, with after consulting with other countries and partners in the region. And so for all the talk about Mr. Trump destroying alliances, ignoring allies, this report and how they wrote it absolutely gives the lie to that, which has been from the beginning. It puts primacy on dealing, working with and through partners, working as a collectively with them. And it addresses, of course, China as the big issue, but it leaves really nothing out. And it's not just a plan for dealing along a military line, but it includes economic, intelligence, political warfare, propaganda, back in the old good meaning of the word, where you're explaining yourself.
And countering the enemy's propaganda, which is insidious.
Yes, that's a big part of it. So, see, it covers every line of effort, and it's very well done, and it gives any, as a plan that allows a country and administration to do anything it needs to do. This is a very, very good one. If the incoming administration were to, say, change the letterhead and use it as their own model, that would be a very good thing. Will they? I don't know. But I hope they do, because it is that well written. It's in some respects timeless.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Grant Newsom, two quick questions because we're nearing the end of our time with you. How well do you think the Trump administration operationalized that plan, point one? And given what we've been seeing so far in terms of the appointments by the Biden team for senior positions in its administration, what do you anticipate will be its actual program rather than perhaps just changing the letterhead on this one and adopting it fully?
I think that the Trump administration really did a very, very good job of making something of this plan. If we had not adopted the plan, which the Trump administration did, I think by now we would have lost. I think we would not be able to, the Chinese would have the upper hand, our allies would be demoralized and would pretty much have given up. And I don't think we would be able to respond. That's how bad the trend was. The Trump administration reversed that and changed course. But now we have to see what happens. You know, what do the new people do? You know, one hopes for the best. As an American, you've got to hope that we have some success here. But you do look at the people who are coming in who've been appointed to positions, and they all have track records in Asia, having worked on Asia policy, handle America's Asian affairs. And you have to ask which one has a demonstrated track record of success. And I don't know who that is. And if I can say that, you know the Chinese know even better. So are the Chinese intimidated by the Biden administration's people? I don't think so. So I'm troubled. But at the same time, as an American, we have to want them to succeed. I hope they do, but we'll find out. But once again, their backgrounds are not exactly things that give you a lot of confidence.
But they do have now a roadmap for success that, if followed, could make a material difference. And I think that is an important point to underscore here. They don't have to revert to form. They don't have to pretend that we've learned nothing in the intervening 4 years since they were last in office, many of them. We can, in fact, have an impact on Chinese behavior, and we'd best be doing that because otherwise, as you say, the prospects are grim for not only the interest of our friends and allies, such as they are in the region, but also for us as well. Grant Newsom, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but we look forward to these conversations with you on an ongoing basis in 2021 and appreciate so much your clear-eyed assessment of what both is going on and what we need to do about it. So come back to us again very soon, if you will. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, about the state of our internal security posture and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And we have in house virtually Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, former counsel in the White Houses of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, former naval intelligence officer, and the author of, among other things, Eagles and Evergreens, a terrific book about a town in Maine that he knows well and World War II veterans there. Robert Charles is also the spokesman for a terrific organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens, better known as AMAC, and you can follow his work there at amac.us. Bobby Charles, a happy new year to you, my friend. I pray it will be one. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you very much, Frank. I guess it's on our shoulders to make it one.
I think it is, in no small measure. And one of the reasons we do this program is to try to equip people to do that. And we've been talking in the run-up to this segment, Bobby, about various challenges, threats we're facing. And one of your pieces at amac.us that caught my eye speaks to sort of where this leads us, and that is, are we, by our actions, by our failures to modernize our nuclear deterrent, for example, or to shore up our alliances in places like the Indo-Pacific, particularly should a Biden administration go down those roads, emboldening our enemies in ways that could be really mortally perilous?
I think you're right on, Frank. I think what we're looking at right now, often we look at what seems closest to us, and closest to us are domestic issues. But in reality, on foreign soil, an awful lot of the world is looking in on us and wondering if we're really at a point of sort of maximum weakness here in recent years. And I don't think we really inherently are, in that if a foreign country, if we can all collect ourselves enough to look outside of Washington, D.C. for a moment and understand that we are vulnerable as a country, as a society, as a sovereign nation. I think we pull together typically when we see that. But right now that's in a blur. It's not clear. So let me, in a way, make it more clear. We have the threats you've already described. There are certainly rising nuclear threats in different locations. There are certainly threats, cyber threats and others. But I would focus explicitly on China, on North Korea, and on Iran. And while Russia is also out there, and there are several other countries that we have to watch closely, and there are a number of non-state actors we're always watching. But I think the reality here is that when we impeach a president with a snap impeachment, which incidentally any lawyer would know really wasn't, not only did it not conform to due process, did it not live by the rules of the road that relate to impeachment over the last 230 years, but it effectively turns our impeachment process into a vote of no confidence, which is a horrible thing for the future. It puts a sort of Damocles over every president. And I would say right now, China's looking at this and they're saying, wow, you know, our economy now is picking up again. The world is not. We got away with the virus. They're knocking down WHO, trying to get in and get to the, you know, virology lab. They're looking at the United States and they're saying, look how weak that democracy is. You've got Iran. By the way, there are specific actions China's taking that are definitely aggressive. I'm worried about Taiwan. I'm worried about the entire region, but I'm also worried about Iran. Iran is pushing the envelope here. And we, you know, for the first time in years, we actually took a boomer in there, one of our Ohio class subs with 154 Tomahawks, and we surfaced it to say, hey, don't get too aggressive. But they're thinking about aggressive. They're threatening. You've got North Korea, who's already talking again about missile launches. You've got other parts of the world. I mean, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see Russia decide that this is the right time to roll into some portion of Eastern Europe. So my concern is that if the United States is disunited, or even sends the perception, since perception is reality, of disunity, our adversaries are quick to think that they've got a leg up, even if they don't. And we just have to be very careful. Yes, they can.
Let me ask you on this question of the impeachment of the president, Bobby Charles. You've worked at senior levels in several administrations, and I know have an appreciation for, as you say, what this process means for the presidency. But I'd ask you specifically about the charges that have been brought against President Trump, specifically the use of this term of incitement of an insurrection. Based on the evidence that we have available to date, is that remotely justified? And what does it mean that these charges have been brought up and now, you know, used against him in this fashion, let alone what's in prospect in the Senate?
Well, again, I look at this, as I said a moment ago, as very dangerous to the Constitution. And unfortunately, a good deal of the damage has already been done. There is no way that any one of the founders believed that what happened out on the Mall was a violation of the First Amendment. That is First Amendment protected speech. There have been thousands of speeches given on the Mall over the last 100 years, encouraging people to go down to Congress and be heard. There is nothing in that speech that rises to the level of impeachable. But I think our founding fathers would be very upset, because they'd be looking at this and they'd be looking at the actual impeachment organ, and they'd also be looking at what happened. You had on the Senate floor, you had senators and you had a number of House members really acting on Article 2, Section 1.2 and the 12th Amendment. There's no way that can be viewed as unconstitutional action. That's actually textually textually permitted action in the Constitution. And then, you know, the whole question of incitement, Frank, comes down to, I just find it remarkable. I mean, more than half of the members of Congress are lawyers. They all had to sit through constitutional law. Brandenburg versus Ohio is the 1969 case that defines incitement. It was when they were all at law school. That case was decided at the height of a highly emotional, racially tense, internationally tense moment. And it was the Earl Warren Court. On that court were people like Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan. And you had Justices White and Black and Stewart. And I'm trying to think who else was on that court. But the bottom line is you had William O. Douglas on that court. That was a liberal court that said the First Amendment, in a very similar case, said, no, this is not incitement. And that involved, incidentally, urging a march on the mall, et cetera, a very hostile language, far more hostile than the president used. And I think the end of the day here, what we're going to look back on, and we're going to say this might have been a very gratifying venting of the spleen by some members in Congress, but it damages the Constitution in such a way that it essentially takes power away from an executive branch and official. So it voids a key element of the separation of powers, and it takes a draconian measure and turns it into a vote of no confidence, essentially a vote of no confidence when both chambers are controlled by the party that's opposite the president, and you can get 50% of one and 2/3 of the other. You can turn a president out of office on just about anything. It should also give a stutter step to a lot of Americans, because the First Amendment language used, if a president can be brought down effectively by First Amendment protected language, than any citizen can. And then if you look forward, what should be done, honestly, if I were Biden, I'd go over there and try to get photo ops with Trump to show him that somehow the two of you can see eye to eye. But more importantly, I would encourage his colleagues in the Senate to dismiss this action, not to let it be a sort of Damocles hanging over. First of all, it's going to help his nominations get out and whatever his legislative agenda is. Second to that, you could go to the Supreme Court and encourage them. The Chief Justice has the opportunity to declare this moot and decide that he will not adjudicate an impeachment here. And then the third option, of course, is that you have a trial. And if you have a trial, whether it's near term or far term, it telegraphs to the entire world that we don't respect our own First Amendment, that the impeachment process that we've always said was sacrosanct is actually not that at all, and that we are weak, divided, and that they might as well take advantage. And to me, that's the most dangerous part. That's right.
Bobby, what do you think the implications are of the Democrats pursuing what seems to be such an unconstitutional approach in the Senate?
I'll be honest with you, Frank. I think they have no idea the downstream damage that this will do, not only to their political agenda, but ultimately for decades out ahead. Arguably, this will be an echo that rings for 100 years, because a president leaving office and then being brought to trial is just so unprecedented. It's not only beyond the intent of the framers, it's beyond the intent of anybody who's realistically been a scholar of impeachment at any point in time. So I see the president doing an interlocutory appeal, possibly winning. Of course, that raises his profile again, but it just drags the entire country, not in the here and now, but into the distant future, drags us through a kind of a unforeseen uncharted waters, that there's no need to do this. There's just no need for this.
And not least, one of the things that may eventuate is that there will be an opportunity afforded to him, both in any trial in the Senate and perhaps in these other proceedings that you think of, maybe in the Supreme Court, to put forward the evidence that he has been denied the opportunity to put forward, and that we're told doesn't exist, of what I call electoral grand larceny. So that's another collateral and unintended effect perhaps as well. Bobby, we have to leave it at that. We've got to go. Thank you so much for your time today, my friend. God bless you. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.